Washington. This is Daybreak Asia. Good morning. I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, suicide car bomb kills five during Afghan presidential campaign. Thailand tightens security as tensions escalate. Hundreds in Vietnam protest a Chinese oil rig. These stories and more in this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Authorities say a suicide car bombing in southern Afghanistan killed at least five people and wounded about 40 others, including soldiers. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad. Violence continues as the Afghan presidential election campaign continues.
The deadly attack occurred in Kandahar province, one of the violence-hit southern Afghan regions where Taliban insurgents routinely carry out such attacks. An Afghan army vehicle was said to be the target of the suicide bombing, in which mostly civilians were killed or wounded. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Meanwhile, Afghan presidential frontrunner Abdullah Abdullah received a boost to his presidential campaign before a runoff election scheduled for mid-June. Former Foreign Minister Zalmay Rasool, who finished third in the April 5th election, endorsed Abdullah, saying they will form a coalition. Speaking together in Kabul, Rasool said national unity, stability, peace and prosperity formed basis of his decision to back Abdullah because Afghans are tired of war and discrimination. The primary reason he said to join hands with Abdullah is to prevent the election from being decided on regional and ethnic grounds. It will also lead Afghanistan to political stability, he added. Rasool was widely seen as a favorite of incumbent President Hamid Karzai, who was unable to participate because of constitutional limits. Abdullah praised the decision of his former rival, describing it as an important step to promote national unity. He said Sunday's decision must have disappointed enemies of Afghanistan who want to see the country remain trapped in an ethnic crisis. Rasool comes from Afghanistan's royal family and draws support largely from the majority Pashtun Afghans, who view Abdullah as a leader of ethnic Tajik community because of his mixed family background. But election observers believe that contrary to traditional practices, Abdullah drew support from Pashtun voters that put him on top of the list of presidential hopefuls in the first round. Another former presidential candidate, Gul Agha Sherzai, once governor of Pashtun-dominated Kandahar province, has already endorsed Abdullah. Abdullah got 45% of the vote in the first round, while his nearest rival, former finance minister Ashraf Ghani, a Pashtun Afghan, finished at 32%. Election authorities will declare the final results of the April 5th presidential polls on Wednesday. A candidate has to garner at least 50% of the vote to win the election in the first round. The decisive second round between Abdullah and Ghani was to be held 2 weeks after the announcement of final results, but election authorities have already delayed it until mid-June. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The completion of the U.S. Transcontinental Railroad and the Chinese immigrants who helped build it are remembered later on Daybreak Asia. Thailand faces a crucial week in its long-running political crisis as fears of violence and civil strife have led to calls by senior security officials to tighten security. Ron Corbin has more for VOA from Bangkok.
Thailand's caretaker government says it is stepping up security to prevent clashes between pro- and anti-government protests. Political tensions are rising amid anti-government calls for a neutral prime minister to be appointed. Department of Special Investigation Chief Tarit Pengdit says calls for a non-elected head of government by the Anti-Government People's Democratic Reform Committee, PDRC, are illegal. Tarit said the PDRC leader Suthep Thongsaban's calls for a non-elected prime minister were illegal and are intensifying conflicts that may lead to violence and even civil war. Meanwhile, leaders from the pro-government Red Shirt movement made similar warnings of growing social conflict as supporters rallied Saturday, many carrying banners of the image of ousted Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. Ms. Yingluck was dismissed along with 9 cabinet members by the Constitutional Court last week on charges of nepotism. She was replaced by Deputy Premier Nitum Tumrong Bun Song Paisan. The government says it hopes to press on with elections scheduled for July 20. February 2 polls were annulled. The governing Pua-Thai party, largely under control of former leader Thaksin Shinawat, hopes to regain the political initiative at the election. Pro-Thaksin parties have won every election since 2001. But the opposition Democrat Party, which boycotted the earlier vote, is threatening to again stay out without political reforms. Chulalongkorn University political scientist Panattan Wattaniagorn says the Thai military has stepped up its presence in Bangkok to prevent clashes by the opposing political camps. Panattan says the political battles are set to escalate over the issues of an appointed prime minister and a royal decree setting a new election for July 20.
The legal battles between the two issues would continue for a few days. In the meantime, I think the supporters of the two groups, you know, the Red Shirt and the PDRC, will drum up their support. And I think the offensive political move will be in the hands of the PDRC. They may move more quickly to pressure, you know, the Senate to act on it. But also the aggressive, you know, move could be adopted by the Red Shirt trying to occupy other strategic locations.
But reports Sunday said military commanders appeared opposed to Suthep's call for the setting up of an interim government. The army has ruled out a military coup, saying it will only intervene if violence escalates. Senior advisor to a pro-government Democratic Force Party, Prasang Mongkonsuri, says behind-the-scenes talks may already be underway, including with Thaksin.
I believe the negotiation is now going on, not by Khun Nivat Thamlong, probably by Khun Thaksin Shinawat. It's some man behind the scene of PDRC. My personal opinion, I believe Khun Thaksin is now trying hard to negotiate to find a good solution for the country.
Thailand's present conflict erupted after Ms. Yingluck's government passed a bill granting a general amnesty that would include clearing the way for Thaksin, who has lived in exile to avoid a jail term for corruption, and return home a free man. But while Thaksin has been strongly supported in the rural areas, he faces opposition in the capital and southern provinces by the urban middle class. He may also have lost support among grassroots backers over failed populist economic policies under Ms. Yingluck's government. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
In Pakistan, more than 2 million people, including children, work as bonded laborers. It is a system the United Nations describes as modern-day slavery. Sharon Bain reports on the life of brickmakers who use their children as collateral for debts to their employers.
Ali has been making bricks since he was a child. Like his father before him, Ali's entire family works to repay money he has borrowed from the factory owner. They get paid roughly $6 per 1,000 bricks.
They take a third of what we earn. They give us some, and they take some for themselves. But this debt never ends, because sometimes we get sick. Sometimes we need it for electricity. Sometimes we take a day off. Then we have to borrow more money, so it never gets paid off.
Ali has tuberculosis. If he dies early, his children will spend their lives working off his loan. The United Nations says these are modern-day slaves, trapped in a cycle of debt they barely understand. Francesco Davidio, head of the UN's International Labour Organization in Islamabad, says international companies are threatening to leave Pakistan if this practice of bonded labour is not abolished.
So in addition to the human rights angle, there is also an economic reason to improve the compliance with these standards. And I must say that Pakistan in particular is feeling this threat very seriously, is taking this threat very seriously.
Zarina Bibi has been working in different brick kilns since she was 8. Extreme poverty means all her children work too.
My children were small and I beat them in order to make them work harder to earn money to feed ourselves.
Then one day I cut my foot and bled a lot. But I had many children, and I thank God that at least we would have food that way.
Until recently, these workers and their families didn't even have birth or death certificates or identification cards. Technically, they didn't even exist. Chaudhry Faiz Rasool is one of the rare factory owners getting his workers' social security cards, giving them access to state welfare programs. But he says the workers' inability to budget is part of the problem.
The government wants us to write off their existing loans. This will destroy everything. You write off their loans today and tomorrow they will again start borrowing. They will leave me, go to another kiln, borrow more money, then come back to me and borrow again, and the whole industry will be destroyed.
Pakistan's economy relies heavily on cheap labor. Extreme poverty, illiteracy, and a lack of skills guarantee that workers and their families readily provide such labor, even if that means they're bonded for life. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Sharon Bain's story has incredible video you will find only on our website. You can see it at voanews.com via your computer or smartphone. Hundreds of people across Vietnam took part in protests Sunday morning, days after Vietnamese and Chinese vessels were reported sparring near a Chinese oil rig in disputed waters in the South China Sea. Marianne Brown reports from the capital.
Hundreds of people across Vietnam took part in anti-China demonstrations Sunday to protest China's deployment of an oil rig near the Paracel Islands, which both countries claim. In a highly unusual move, the protests were covered in state-run media. Such protests are usually strictly controlled by police and participants are often prevented from attending. Vietnam! Vietnam! In Hanoi, around 500 Vietnam! People gathered in a park opposite Vietnam! The Chinese embassy, the biggest anti-China protest to take place here for many years. Some banners read, "China back off from Vietnamese waters," and "The Paracel and Spratly Islands belong to Vietnam." One poster, which was perhaps telling of the mood, read, "We entirely trust the party, the government, and the People's Army." Earlier this week, Vietnamese and Chinese vessels clashed near a Chinese state-owned oil rig in disputed waters in the South China Sea. Vietnam accused the Chinese ships of repeatedly ramming the Vietnamese ships and using water cannon, injuring six crewmen. Beijing said Vietnam continues to send ships to the area, threatening Chinese personnel. One protester, Tang, says she believes many people are worried about how the situation might escalate.
The war really happened in Vietnam and China will be very bad with almost all the people in Vietnam. And even so, my family live in Cao Bang. And like you know, before, in 1979, the war happened between Vietnam and China. Our family, our house were destroyed. We live really close China border, so really afraid about it.
Although the road to the Chinese embassy building itself was blocked by police, the crowd had an uninterrupted view of the gates. Several regular protest participants said it was the first time they had been allowed to protest so close to the Chinese embassy. However, not everyone was taking their freedom to protest for granted. Hugh Ngoc Lum is a regular participant. He said before he joined the gathering, he told his wife to take his motorbike home if he was detained by police. He said even though he is nearly 70 years old, he is a patriot and is not afraid of the police, eliciting applause from the crowd. The confrontation over the islands, which Chinese forces seized from then South Vietnam in 1974, has raised fears of growing tensions between the two countries. During a visit to Hanoi Thursday, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Russell urged both sides to refrain from unilateral actions. Foreign ministers from the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations issued a statement Saturday ahead of Sunday's ASEAN summit, expressing concern and urging restraint by all parties. Beijing claims nearly all of the South China Sea, which contains key shipping lanes and is believed to be rich in oil and gas deposits. Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines and Brunei have competing claims to different areas of the sea, as does Taiwan. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
Indonesia is home to one of the largest areas of tropical rainforest in the world and has one of the highest rates of deforestation. But there are signs of progress in efforts to balance economic growth with conservation of the natural rainforests. From Jakarta, Kate Lamb reports.
During recent decades, millions of hectares of Indonesian forest have been cleared through illegal logging and the creation of plantations for the timber, pulp and paper, and palm oil industries. In 2010, the governments of Norway and Indonesia signed a $1 billion deal to impose a moratorium on the clearance of peatland and natural forest. The deal was seen as a way to help Indonesia meet its ambitious goal of cutting carbon emissions by 26% by 2020. But despite the ban, natural forests have continued to be cleared for industry, in part due to weak governance and rampant corruption. For years, scientists and environmentalists have struggled to convince rural Indonesians that protecting forests is in their long-term interests. Scientist Eric Mejad says the message is now starting to penetrate because people realize there are huge economic costs to destroying the forest.
Large groups of people are starting to work out that the benefits that are being offered, the increased employment, opportunities, infrastructure, so do not outweigh the cost. Those people are saying that very clearly, and this is something the government could use as input.
Mejad has spent years mapping people's perceptions about forest destruction on the island of Kalimantan. Several large companies operating in the oil palm and pulp and paper industries in Indonesia have recently pledged commitments to zero deforestation, while the government is also starting to prosecute companies that illegally slash and burn. Fadil Hassan, the executive director of the Indonesian Palm Oil Association, says that although sustainability won't happen overnight, the palm oil industry is heading in the right direction. For a start, the Indonesian Sustainable Palm Oil Standard, or ISPO, will become mandatory by the end of this year.
In 2011, the Indonesian government itself launched the Indonesian Sustainable Palm Oil. And then hopefully in 2014, all oil palm plantation operated in Indonesia have been certified by ISPO, by Indonesian Sustainable Palm Oil. So looking forward, you know, we are improving.
Indonesia is the world's largest producer of palm oil, which is widely used in consumer goods such as soap and lipstick, and the industry employs more than 5 million people here. While the Indonesian Palm Oil Association says that only a small percentage of plantations are developed in natural forests, indigenous groups argue that forest clearance is coming at their expense. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
Last week marked the 145th anniversary of the completion of the U.S. Transcontinental Railroad. Nearly 2,000 miles of rail were constructed between 1863 and 1869, linking the eastern United States to the west. Chinese immigrants who worked on that railroad were inducted into the U.S. Department of Labor's Hall of Honor. The group of more than 12,000 Chinese laborers are the first Asian Americans to be inducted into the hall since its creation in 1988. At the ceremony Friday, Deputy Secretary Chris Liu said by sharing the story of the Chinese immigrants who worked on the Transcontinental Railroad, it is a reminder the United States has benefited from many waves of industrious immigrants.
In immigrant families, there's a special place of honor for the first to come to the country, the first to face the unknown, the first to plant roots so that others could join them. So for the community of 18 million Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in this country, the Chinese railroad workers are part of our first. They pushed open a door so that generations could follow them. The story of their successes has been missing in history for far too long, and that is why we honor them today.
Historian Connie Young New represented the descendants of the railroad workers at the induction, and her great-grandfather, Lee Wong Song, was a Chinese laborer on the railroad. Speaking at a separate event at the Chinese Community Church here in Washington, Yu said she was honored to be at the ceremony.
You know, it's a great celebration, and we're supposed to be so excited about having the word Chinese on the wall of labor. But it's also, you know, it's a sober reminder of what happened in our history.
Well, for more on that history, Daybreak Asia's Ashley Westerman spoke with Sue Lee, executive director of the Chinese Historical Society of America. Lee said the Chinese railroad workers' induction into the Labor Hall of Honor was finally the recognition they deserved.
Recognition of their hard work, a recognition that they were the backbone of the labor force that built the Central Pacific portion of the Transcontinental Railroad. We had descendants in the audience who were very moved by the ceremony because they had heard throughout their lives, their families had passed the stories down through the generations about how difficult and arduous the work was and how little recognition and acknowledgement they had received.
What does it mean for the Chinese American community in the U.S. to have these workers recognized?
I think emotionally, it's really important to receive that validation, that recognition. But for the community itself, you know, I think it's a reminder about our pioneering history and the importance and significance of those early Chinese in the face of racism and barriers and continuing discrimination throughout the time that even after the railroad were finished. Mm-hmm. You know, they couldn't find jobs. It was hard to settle down in communities. Chinese women weren't allowed into this country. They couldn't start families. So despite all that, the Chinese community survived, at least. And when immigration laws changed in 1968, you know, this new population, our newcomers, are learning about the legacy of the work of these pioneering railroad workers.
As part of the Chinese Historical Society, what are you all doing to help young Chinese to kind of help connect them with that past? And what are some of the lessons that they can draw from the Transcontinental Railroad workers?
That's a really good question, because the railroad work happened 145 years ago. It was a very long time ago. But I think that the lessons that young people can draw from those early pioneers is something that they can carry with them throughout their lives and can serve as guiding stars, if you will, to their full participation in American life, civic life, and to know that the opportunities they currently have to pursue their professions, their interests, their passions are wide open because of the legacy of those early pioneers. And we hope, as the Chinese Historical Society, that young people are inspired hearing about the ceremony, and that they delve into their own history. Because you never know, there are people even today who are discovering for the first time that their families had some connection to those early railroad workers. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have our own history to piece together and to rediscover.
Sue Lee, executive director of the Chinese Historical Society, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ashley Westerman. Stay tuned. The latest world news is coming your way next. Steve Norman has International Edition for you. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
It's one small step for man.
I have a dream.